This author of Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit, Sexing the Cherry, Written on the Body, and the Power Book, just to name a few, is the bad girl extraordinaire of her native British tabloids.
What I love about our story is that it starts as a light comedy and ends as something very dark.
It's illogical to suppose there's only one killer.
I don't believe I know who you are. Or what?
Welcome to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. U.S. bishops announce new policy for an old prejudice, a lesbian literary bad girl shoulders the weight, and another film chronicles the infamous Capote. All that and more this week now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm John Beaupre.
And I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending October 21st, 2006. U.S. Roman Catholic bishops announced this week that they are developing new guidelines for ministry to homosexuals while reaffirming church opposition to same-gender marriage and adoption by lesbians and gay men. The draft document encourages parishes to make gays and lesbians feel welcome and provide them pastoral support, claiming that many are ardently striving to live their faith within the Catholic community so as not to fall into the lifestyle and values of a gay subculture. The proposed guidelines in development since 2002 may be amended, but a final vote on them will be held at the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops meeting in mid-November in Baltimore, Maryland. While condemning discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation, the draft document reaffirms the Catholic view of homosexual attraction as disordered, and that same-gender relationships violate the true purpose of sexuality, as do adultery and contraception. Catholic teaching is based on objective moral norms, not prejudice, the authors claim, and gays and lesbians should learn to live chastely and celibately. The document reportedly also says that Catholics should be denied Holy Communion if they lack adherence to what the Church authoritatively teaches on matters of faith and morals. Matt Foreman, executive director of the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force, wrote that much of the lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered community is working to protect our families, to be protected from discrimination and violence, and to have the freedom to serve in the U.S. military. So much for the immoral lifestyles we are supposedly creating.
The Roman Catholic priest, named by disgraced Republican Congressman Mark Foley as having sexually abused him as a teenager, spoke with reporters this week. From his home on the Mediterranean island of Gozo in Malta, now 72-year-old Anthony Mersica talked about the intimate two-year relationship he had with Foley when the former congressman was a teenage altar boy living in Lake Worth, Florida. He described activities that he says now might be perceived as sexually inappropriate, but called his relationship with Foley innocent. Among those activities, massaging Foley while the boy was naked, skinny dipping together at a secluded lake, and being naked in the same room on overnight trips. Foley family sources, who requested anonymity, told reporters that the two did have one sexual encounter that took place when Foley was 12 or 13. The priest told reporters that he may have been going through a nervous breakdown at the time, which he said affected my mind a little bit. Experts say that a refusal to accept responsibility for their actions is typical of many sexually abusive priests. Mersica said he doesn't understand why Foley has decided to come forward after almost 40 years, wondering if he was looking for a scapegoat. Why does he want to destroy me in my old age, he asked. According to a website for the Diocese of Gozo, Mersica is still listed as one of its active priests. Meanwhile, the U.S. House Ethics Committee continues to hear closed-door testimony about the Foley scandal amid conflicting statements from Republican leadership officials about who knew what and when they knew it.
As we reported last week, former Democratic U.S. Representative Gary Studs of Massachusetts, the first openly gay member of Congress, died on October 14th at the age of 69. In 2004, he married longtime partner Dean Hara after same-gender marriage was legalized in their state. But unlike the legal spouses of other members of Congress who've died, Hara won't be receiving any portion of Studs' annual federal pension, which in this case would be about $62,000, because the 1996 Defense of Marriage Act blocks the U.S. government from recognizing their marriage. Under federal law, pensions can otherwise only be denied to those convicted of espionage or treason. Hara has thus far declined public comment on the pension issue. The National Taxpayers Union, a nonprofit citizen watchdog group, noted that U.S. Congressman Bob Ney, the Ohio Republican who pled guilty last week to conspiracy charges and faces up to 10 years behind bars for taking bribes from disgraced lobbyist Jack Abramoff, will still receive his congressional pension for the rest of his life, even while he's in prison.
Two British lesbians have abandoned their battle to force the United Kingdom to recognize their Canadian marriage. In July, the High Court Family Division upheld a UK law that automatically converted Sue Wilkinson and Celia Kitzinger's Canadian marriage into a civil partnership, as it does for all legal same-gender marriages conducted in other countries. The court also slammed the couple with the equivalent of more than $46,000 in court costs. Wilkinson and Kitzinger say that's close to their life savings and that they have no money to appeal the decision. This financial penalty is clearly intended to deter us from seeking justice, they wrote in an email. We will campaign in other ways instead.
Ireland's High Court reserved judgment last week in a lawsuit filed by another lesbian couple married in Canada who seek to have their legal union recognized. Dr. Catherine Zapponi and Dr. Anne Louise Gilligan want Ireland to recognize their Canadian marriage or give them the right to marry there. High Court Justice Elizabeth Dunn didn't indicate when she would issue her decision.
Meanwhile, the European Commission has funded a two-year project called Family Matters, supporting families to prevent violence against gay and lesbian youth. It will be run by the Department of Social Research at Italy's University of East Piedmont and by groups for parents, families, and friends of gays and lesbians in Italy, Spain, and the United Kingdom. The money will be spent on polling, on identifying public and social service sector good practice for families of homosexual young people, and to produce educational material, a documentary video, and a website. The commission said lesbian and gay youth frequently lack support and role models, and that families of gays and lesbians need help to accept their children and assist them in dealing with self-esteem, bullying, and discrimination.
Hong Kong's government this week decided not to appeal a judicial ruling against its unequal age of consent law. While it still requires formal legislation, the move effectively lowers the homosexual age of consent in China's special administrative region from 21 to 16. In his ruling that the unequal law governing the age of consent for homosexual relations was unconstitutional, Chief High Court Judge Jeffrey Ma wrote that no evidence has been placed before us to explain why the minimum age requirement for buggery is 21, whereas as far as sexual intercourse between a man and a woman is concerned, the age of consent is only 16. In a brief statement, Hong Kong Security Bureau said it would not challenge the court's decision, saying only that, after considering all the relevant factors, the government decided not to appeal the judicial review.
Lesbian and gay Iranians seeking asylum in the Netherlands will now be granted full resident status, according to an announcement this week by Dutch Immigration Minister Rita Verdonk. She had declared her intention earlier this year to end a moratorium on deportation of lesbi-gay Iranians, saying that they could not claim possible persecution if they were returned to their home country. For homosexual men and women in Iran, she said, it is not totally impossible to function in society, although they should be wary of coming out of the closet too openly. But after strong protests from Dutch and international human rights organizations, Verdonk reinstated the deportation ban for 6 months, pending a review of conditions in Iran. While there has been some disagreement among global human rights groups about whether or not the death penalty for homosexuality is being implemented in Iran, Verdonk said her decision this week was based primarily on new reports by Human Rights Watch. That group noted that Iran's Sharia Penal Code, the Code of Islamic Punishments, calls for the death penalty for homosexual male intercourse. Non-penetrative sex between men, the group says, is punishable by 100 lashes for the first 3 convictions and execution the 4th time. In addition, men who are not related by blood and lie naked under the same cover without any necessity can be punished with 99 lashes. Sex between women is punishable by 100 lashes for the first 2 convictions and execution the 3rd time. Human Rights Watch said this month that the government of President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad has tightened restrictions on civil society and increased punishments for dissent in recent months, including death sentences for so-called morals offenses.
But the Office of Turkey's Public Prosecutor has dismissed an attempt by the governor of Bursa to shut down that province's transgender and gay rights group, Gürkesaki Dernegi, or Rainbow Association. Members of the group were forced to retreat inside their meeting place earlier this year after religious zealots and football hooligans attacked them as they attempted to hold a first-ever Pride March. The governor's office had claimed the group's existence violated laws that ban organizations that promote activities that are illegal or offend public morality. In its determination, the prosecutor's office wrote that homosexuality is not an offense and that the Rainbow Association exists to reach accord with society and defend their rights while explaining their identity. The ruling concluded that the group had not acted with a deliberate intention of offense.
And finally, rock star Melissa Etheridge and her spouse Tammy Lynn Michaels have announced the arrival of twins, Miller Steven, a boy, and Johnny Rose, a girl. They were welcomed into the world by Melissa and birth mother Tammy on October 17th. Michaels and the twins are all reported to be doing well. According to a statement on Melissa's website, the creation of life brings about immeasurable love and pours hope into the future. The joy will help carry us through our upcoming sleepless nights.
That's News Wrap for the week ending October 21st, 2006. Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap was written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
And I'm John Beaupre.
Hello, I'm Dr. Robert Simmons, Jr. of Lebanon, Ohio. A longtime This Way Out listener and donor. In memory of my mother, Mabel Simmons, I'm issuing a matching challenge to supporters of this volunteer-driven nonprofit operation. Please visit thiswayout.org to see how your help to keep this program on the air will now be worth twice as much. You'll also get a tax deduction if you're in the United States, and you'll find some unique holiday gifts there too. Again, please log on to thiswayout.org. We'll all be very thankful.
She conquered sleeping sickness. He observed sickness of another kind. You'll hear about a scientist and a celebrity later in the program. But first, This Way Out correspondent Janet Mason gets passionate about a leading lesbian author's latest effort.
In Wait, The Myth of Atlas and Heracles by Jeanette Winterson, published by Canongate, Winterson revisits and reinvents the myth of Atlas with the express purpose of wanting to tell the story again. She explains that as a fiction writer, she has the freedom to retell the same story, the stories we think we know, and record them differently. Perhaps all artists are a little compulsive. Obsessive. I understand the need to tell the story again, the revisiting of old mysteries, the attempt to make sense of the nonsensical. The writing of this review is a retelling of the story. But first, I want to retell the story of Jeanette Winterson in a nutshell. In a chance encounter with a friend before a reading that Jeanette was giving, the friend gasped, "I read everything and loved it, particularly The Passion." This kind of audible response is rare enough to be delightful, and it yet is not uncommon among Jeanette Winterson's followers in what is loosely known as the lesbian community. This author of Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit, Sexing the Cherry, Written on the Body, and The Power Book, just to name a few, is the bad girl extraordinaire of her native British tabloids, as she woos away men's wives and responds rudely to criticism. But it's not her persona that causes the audible response. It is her brilliance on the page. Winterson begins her first-person odyssey as Atlas with a statement that the free man never thinks of escape. And thus begins the tale of Atlas trapped in his life, longing for freedom, and Jeanette just as trapped with what she calls her monsters, and the two of them thinking their way through to an open door where Atlas can lay down his burden and Jeanette can walk away from the weight of the world. She presents the reader with a cosmology of the universe as it exists around and inside of each one of us. What is it that you contain, the dead, time, light patterns of millennia opening up in your gut? Every minute in each of you, a few million potassium atoms succumb to radioactive decay. The energy that powers these tiny atomic events has been locked inside potassium atoms ever since a star-sized bomb exploded into being. Potassium, like uranium and radium, is a long-lived radioactive nuclear waste of the supernova bang that accounts for you. Your first parent was a star. Along the way, we see the heroics and the flaws of those who live on Mount Olympus, and we are privileged to witness their mundane daily lives. Atlas holding up the world for all eternity, Prometheus having his liver torn out day after day, the endless bickering of Hera and Zeus in an arrangement called marriage. As myths go, this one really is no different. It is full of deceit, betrayal, and courage. It tells the story of how others have lived and do live their lives, so that we can have more insight into our own. Ultimately, Winterson breathes new life into an old story, or perhaps it is the story, and her chosen persona of Atlas that lends new meaning to her as a writer, retelling her own story, unraveling her own intricacies. Winterson, as story retelling, explains that every body of knowledge is incomplete. If only I understood that the globe itself, complete, perfect, unique, is a story. Science is a story. History is a story. These are the stories we tell ourselves to make ourselves come true.
This is Janet Mason for This Way Out.
Dr. Louise Pierce, renowned woman scientist of her time, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. Louise Pierce was born in Massachusetts in 1885 and was one of the first women to earn a degree in physiology. She earned her medical degree from Johns Hopkins 5 years later. Pierce was one of the leading women scientists of the early 20th century. She traveled to the Belgian Congo with drugs she'd helped develop to treat African sleeping sickness. She tested it on 70 patients with miraculous results. The drug eradicated the parasitic disease within weeks, eliminating symptoms and restoring general health in even extreme cases, curing over 100,000 Africans. Belgian officials awarded her the Ancient Order of the Crown of Belgium. Pierce spent her last years in New Jersey sharing a home with author Ida A.R. Wiley and noted New York City health physician Josephine Baker. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Mary Gay Hutcherson.
This is Dorothy Allison, author of Bastard Out of Carolina and numerous trashy pieces. You're listening to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine.
Queer.
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 Radio.
Thing called love, this funny thing called love. Just who can solve its mystery? Why should it make a fool of me?
Last year, critics, audiences, and Academy voters went wild for Capote, a film about the groundbreaking author as he wrote his classic In Cold Blood. Now, Infamous, a film shot at roughly the same time and covering roughly the same period in Truman Capote's life, is lighting up movie screens to similar acclaim. This Way Out, Steve Pride probed the filmmaker and stars of Infamous to find out what it was about this diminutive gay man that made one small part of his story big enough for two great movies.
During his research for his book In Cold Blood, an account of the murder of a Kansas family, the writer Truman Capote developed a close relationship with Perry Smith, one of the killers. This period was the basis of last year's Oscar-nominated film, Capote. When word got around that another film covering the same ground was in the works, there was a bit of snickering. But the film Infamous is nothing to laugh at, although it has the humor that was sorely missing in the earlier film. It also captures the charm and bravery of a tiny gay man who is flamboyantly out in 1959.
What I love about our story is that it starts as a light comedy and ends as something very dark, with him in a very, very different place.
The writer and director of Infamous, Douglas McGrath.
Essentially, the bulk of the movie covers a period of about 6 to 8 months. There's a passage of a few years by the end, but essentially it covers a very small period, and yet I think it tells both the triumph and the tragedy of his life in that period.
Detective Will.
Jimmy.
Will you confirm that there is more than one killer?
I will not.
Well, of course there was more than one, unless the killer was a hypnotist.
Beg your pardon, ma'am?
It's illogical to suppose there's only one killer. The Clutters were tied up. To tie them up, he'd have to put his gun down. Once he put the gun down, the Cutters would run for the hills.
I don't believe I know who you are. Or what?
I'm from out of town.
What's your paper?
Ladies Home Journal.
Oh, I'm not a reporter. I'm a writer.
English actor Toby Jones is almost a double for Truman Capote, and he gives us a man a great deal more fun and likable than we expected. But what were his personal feelings about the man he played?
Do I like Truman Capote? It seems such a simple question, but it isn't really a simple question because, in a sense, we can see Capote's life as a series of events now, and I can explore his life from a certain amount of events, but I don't actually have to meet the guy in the present moment. I see his life in terms of a whole history. So although it's a simple question, I'd say yes, I do like Capote, but that's because I know a lot about his life now. But if I was to meet him, would I like him? I don't know if I would.
And does he think that Truman Capote's flamboyance was a form of bravery?
For a long time, I was just trying to understand this persona that Capote created, the combination of the glasses, the very careful stylized hair, and, you know, the voice. And for an English person not very versed in Capote, it's an extraordinary impact. And it's not hard to imagine the impact he would have had in Kansas. And for a long time, I thought long and hard about this courage that he showed. But it's also a certain level of arrogance as well, that he feels so powerful, that this mask that he wears gives him such a sense of empowerment that he feels he can walk in anywhere. And people talk about other times when Mailer talks about him going to a bar, an Irish navvy bar, with Capote in a gabardine cape. And people talk about the impact of the Capote shell, as it were. Now, in a way, that sort of functions, I think, in a way that I think camp functions as a sort of, it's both a strategy for short-circuiting aggression and playing with aggression and also defending yourself from aggression. But as you say, it's all proto-gay culture. It's all sort of self-discovered strategies for dealing with a hostile world, in a way.
What about Terry?
It's Perry. Oh. As in Antoinette? He's an enigma. You know, before he killed the Cutter boy, he put a pillow under his head, and he wouldn't let Dick rape the girl.
He's not all kind.
Jack's right. After these demonstrations of gentility, he did shoot them dead.
And cut the old man's throat.
So there's something, I can't quite put my finger on it. It seems insane to say that he's tender, but he does have the tender and the terrible side by side inside him.
I think Doug's pretty clear that he fell in love with him. In the Plimpton book, there's speculation about the nature of their relationship, and, you know, there's what I think is rather wild speculation that they could have had sex, which seems to me highly implausible. In our film, there is a level of intimacy reached that I think is, if it's not love, then it's certainly a kind of confusion that might become love. There's a sort of giddiness. I think that Capote recognises in Perry Smith so much unfulfilled potential that he, as a writer, was able to fulfil for himself, that he'd achieved, and he was in the business of achieving a level of self-fulfillment. And I think almost a twinning goes on, and a certain degree of sympathy goes on with Perry Smith that leads to a level of intimacy. You know, he's able to get inside Perry Smith's head.
Sandra Bullock plays Harper Lee, who is the author of To Kill a Mockingbird and a lifelong friend of Truman Capote. Catherine Keener received an Oscar nomination for playing the same role in that other Truman Capote film. While Bullock's performance is astounding, perhaps even career-defining, it's impossible to not make comparisons between the two films. I asked Bullock why someone who has already seen Capote should now see Infamous.
Different point of view. The writing, the performances, the humanity, the humor in it. Truman Capote was a funny little guy. He was perverted. He was smart. He was sharp. He would take you down. He was evil. He was brilliant, you know, and he was complicated, and he was a damaged, damaged child. And he always remained a damaged, damaged child. I think the character study is just brilliant, you know. Look at what Doug wrote and look at what Toby executed, and it's another way of looking at the whole story and digging up a little more, and I hope someone else does a stage production of Capote and brings up another side of it, you know. You don't leave wondering. You leave, I really feel, satiated with our slice of the pie, whereas Capote gave us their slice of the pie and you were fulfilled there, you'll be fully fulfilled with ours.
Infamous has a star-studded cast that includes Sigourney Weaver, Isabella Rossellini, Peter Bogdanovich, Jeff Daniels, and the song stylings of Gwyneth Paltrow. Out gay actor John Benjamin Hickey is Truman Capote's boyfriend, Jack Dumphy. Lee Pace, best known for playing Calpurnia Adams in Soldier's Girl, is Dick Hickok, one of the killers. And the other killer, Perry Smith, is played by the new 007, Daniel Craig, who not only exchanges a hot kiss with Capote, but manages a jailhouse serenade.
There's a gold mine in the sky, far away. We will find it, you and I, some sweet day.
After In Cold Blood, Truman Capote never completed another book. It's believed that the process of writing it destroyed him. It's a hypothesis recounted in several biographies, and now two films.
It's hard to imagine what it must have been like.
Actor Toby Jones.
There are those beautiful pictures of him as a sort of boy man, you know, around about 18, 19, 20. And I think it was, if you like, the journey that he went on between that and the sort of leery, lurching figure that he became at the end that led Doug to try and find what was the turning point. How did that brilliant, confident boy become this sort of parody of himself and bitchy, dissolute queen at the end? And I think that Doug locates it to a sort of intimacy that got under the Capote shell, and that Doug thinks happened in that prison cell. And I think without that intimacy, it's hard to explain, you know, it's hard to understand how such a brilliant man could have fallen apart so dramatically.
This has been a conversation with Douglas McGrath, Toby Jones, and Sandra Bullock. Infamous is being released in the U.S. by Warner Independent Pictures. You can find more info at infamousmovie.com and prideonscreen.com. This is Steve Pride. Thanks for listening.
Love flew in from my window. I was so happy then. But after love, it stayed a little while. Love flew out.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. This week, John Beaupre, Tanya Kane Perry, Rex Walkner with Bill Kelly, Graham Underhill, Janet Mason, Judd Proctor, and Brian Burns with Mary Gay Hutcherson, and Steve Pride contributed program material. You heard Gwyneth Paltrow and Daniel Craig from the Infamous soundtrack, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen online to This Way Out anytime, exclusively at outinamerica.com. You can also click on the link at the top of our website, thiswayout.org. Most This Way Out operating expenses are funded by direct charitable donations from you, our listeners, and we thank you. Please log on to thiswayout.org to see how your help to keep this program on the air is now worth twice as much to us, and choose from some special CD thank you gifts. To sign up for our weekly email program information messages and or our occasional This Way Out updates, email tworadio@aol.com. You can also write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening on WPSUNB, University Park in Kane, Pennsylvania, Planet FM, Auckland, New Zealand, KRCC, Colorado Springs, Colorado, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.